Driven by global threats and a rise in the U.S. defense spending, the aerospace and defense industry worldwide will see some growth this year after falling for a couple of years. That's the assessment from Deloitte in its annual performance study. Joining me with more, retired Air Force General Chuck Wald, Vice Chairman and Senior Advisor at Deloitte. Chuck, great to have you back.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Good to be back.
And so you're looking at a rise in worldwide spending. Give us some of the particulars of what you're seeing.
Well, what we look at, as you alluded to in our report, the Global Defense Outlook for 2016 is the top 50 nations in the world that spend over 95% of all the defense spending, or better said, the top 50, and how that spending we see occurring for 2017 through 2020. And I think the big takeaways are two things that you mentioned earlier. There is a change that's maybe a little more optimistic. And that is, out of the top 50, 12 nations will actually have a decrease in spending, led, ironically, by the United States. But those top 12 out of the 50 will decrease spending by $44 billion. The U.S. will decrease by $38 billion through 2020. The bottom 41, though, will increase by about $91 billion. That's a net of around $50 billion or so. So overall, globally, the defense spending will actually increase, although the top few will change. Also, we have done an index this year, as you probably have read, and that index talks specifically about where we rate different countries in the world from the standpoint of their defense spending. Now, a couple things. One, the global economy and Brexit that just occurred recently, the UK departure of the EU, even though that will take some time, will have an effect on that. But the overall spending for defense globally is going to continue to incrementally increase. And we've based the country indexes on several items, seven specifically, that I can go through if you'd like later.
Well, let me ask you this. It seems a little ironic that given the rise in world tensions, that some of those lower spending countries are actually increasing spending enough to offset decreases from the big countries like the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what you're seeing is, in particular, from the standpoint of terrorism or extremism in the lower half, and again, we're only talking the top nine are the ones that are really decreasing spending significantly or measurably, and then, of course, the lower 41 are increasing. Overall net increase. But if you look at terrorism, in 2005 to 2007, there were 72 persistent terrorist groups identified globally in the world. Since that time, through 2012 and 2014, that number of groups has increased to 144 persistent groups. And the most lethal groups, those that have killed more than 50 people per year, have increased from in 2005 to 2007, only 15, to now they're doubled to more than 38 of those groups in the world. So you look at extremism, policing, terrorism, add on to that immigration, which people are concerned with from the standpoint of border security, and cyber, and you start looking at some of the, what we would consider the lower end of the top 50 spending is going to increase because of concern about national security.
We're speaking with retired Air Force General Chuck Wald, Vice Chairman and Senior Advisor at Deloitte. And when you look at some of the companies around the world that will benefit from spending that is not rising in the United States, do our large companies, the Boeings, the Lockheed Martins, the Northrop Grummans, are they the beneficiaries, or is it more the Finmeccanicas, the Saabs, some of the big contractors outside of the United States?
Well, I would say the latter are probably the more significantly impacted because of the size of their defense spending. If you look at Boeing and Lockheed Martin, et cetera, some of the larger companies, Lockheed, for example, has almost $38 billion of U.S. defense agency spending by spending by the U.S. defense agencies on their equipment. So it's huge. Boeing's in there around $18 billion. But again, the things that are going to be focused on are probably added capabilities to existing platforms, sensors. If you look at the area that I think has changed the most over the last, say, 10 to 15 years in the defense arena from the standpoint of emphasis, is that we've gone from what I would call easy to find, hard to kill targets in the old days. That would be during the Cold War, where tanks were the targets we were looking at. They were easy to find and hard to kill because of precision required. And now it's hard to find, easy to kill. And that's a euphemism for extremists, individual people that are out there doing great harm to our nations. And so intelligence has become the most important part of our defense, I think, for all of our nations, but particularly for the U.S. and our allies. So a lot of money on knowledge, information, finding things, analyzing things, video analytics, communicating things. There's going to be a lot of emphasis on artificial intelligence, on automation, information automation, and sensors. So you shift that look, I think, and now you've got some of the companies you mentioned as well, and maybe the second large OEM tier or even second tier, that have a lot of opportunity to develop systems that are additive to existing systems or additive to existing capabilities for networking. So I think finding things, knowing things, transmitting data is going to be significant. Now, some of that's going to be on platforms like UAVs or other sensors, but much of it has to do with types of automation and types of instrumentation. And the big thing for the U.S. is going to be in what we call the third offset. That is going to be, what is the new technology that the United States is trying to define and create that will give us a significant advantage over the enemy? And I think, again, as mentioned, artificial intelligence, automation, machine learning, and sensor capability is going to be where the action is.
We're speaking with retired Air Force General Chuck Wald, Vice Chairman and Senior Advisor at Deloitte. And getting back to the question of conventional warfare, or more conventional warfare, it seems like the biggest threat now that we know of on land is Russia, not so much to the United States, but to our interests and to nations that we are interested in allies. To what extent is Russian activity driving what some of the countries, say, in Eastern Europe are spending?
Well, that's a great point. If you look at the spectrum of potential conflict, it goes all the way down from an individual all the way back up to nuclear warfare. Nuclear warfare is still there. The threat of it's still there. The requirement to have deterrence is still there. Almost put that in a separate category of importance. It's something you just can't fail at. You have to pay attention to. But on the conventional side, large landmass warfare or large warfare country to country, all the way down to individual terrorism type activity, is now the spectrum. And ironically, I think many of us had hoped for and maybe wished for that a large conventional nation-on-nation, say, alliance-on-alliance type warfare had gone away after the Cold War. And here we are, as you point out, with Russia in Eastern Europe and in Ukraine and Crimea, now again threatening the alliance of NATO. And you'll see, as you have noted, NATO now is going to increase their number of troops in the Baltics by around 4,000. They've increased the presence of armor. They've had increased their air presence, their surveillance presence. And Russia has put three divisions of Russian troops on their side of the border. So although I don't think any of us would bet we're going to have large international conventional warfare here tomorrow, you never know how these things play out from the standpoint of unintended consequences and unpredictability. And I would contend that probably in the history, nobody's ever really predicted the actual beginning of a real tough conflict of some sort or what precipitated that. In retrospect, it's obvious, but we're not ahead of it. So what I'm getting at here is we're probably going to have to be hedge our bets, continue to support NATO in a large way, be a part of NATO, obviously, but with our troop presence, the cost of that will increase in Eastern Europe. NATO is going to have to play their part, and that will continue. And then you add China in the South China Sea with the Spratly Islands and our alliances with Japan and Korea. We're going to have to continue to pay attention there. North Korea firing off potential nuclear warhead missiles in the future out there that could reach some of our bases in Guam and all the way, obviously, to Japan very easily. That's a huge threat. And then you add the instability around the world that we see every day on TV of extremism and terrorism. We're probably in a more complex world right now than any other time, say, since World War II, where obviously global wars a lot different, but this is probably the most turbulent, volatile time we've lived in.
So it seems like perhaps the biggest threat to the balance, such that it is, that exists now, would be maybe a major mistake by somebody in these flyovers where the, you know, the buzzing of aircraft carriers and destroyers and planes coming close to one another. If somebody decides to shoot back, for example, that could change everything overnight.
No, absolutely. I think you just hit the nail on the head. Is the unpredictable, volatile nature of the world we live in. And you know, I'm not sure what the analogy might be, but to put forces next to each other, even though I don't have my gut feel is Russia does not want to necessarily invade NATO right now, obviously, and but they're showing their fangs a little bit in Eastern Europe. But the unpredictable nature of that close contact, if you will, and unintended consequences is the danger. And so, again, from a military person's perspective, you have to be prepared for not the most likely necessarily, but the potentially likely, but high-risk activity. And so do I think we're going to be in a large major war with Russia in the near term? My bet would be no, but based on your point, we don't know for sure. And we can't miss that bet, so we have to at least hedge against it and put our troops out there, which is costly. And again, it's kind of counterintuitive because it causes potential friction just by being there. But it's there. Same thing in the South China Sea. And then you go add on the fact that we have this extremist problem, mainly in the Middle East, but also in Africa, and now in our NATO countries, and obviously here in the United States from a what looks like a lone wolf type activity. But those activities continue. And so I see the need for continued defense spending, for continued international cooperation, and for continued creative R&D, research and development by our defense industry. And it's going to continue for the foreseeable future.
We're speaking with retired Air Force General Chuck Wald, Vice Chairman and Senior Advisor at Deloitte. And finally, if you would interpret the meaning, because there are a lot of interpretations out there, between the fact that the spending levels of the USA versus China and Russia. Russia, you know, $84 billion, China, $216 billion, the United States, if you include the OCO, $610 billion.
Right.
What does that mean in terms of throw power?
Well, I think that is a really good point in question, and I talk about it all the time. I mean, the United States is, you know, we don't like to say it because it makes us not look not humble, I guess, or whatever you want to call it. But we are the big boys on the block. We're the most influential nation in the world. We do the majority of world policing, if you will, and $600 billion. Is probably more than the next, as you point out, four or five top countries in the world on defense spending. Matter of fact, our intelligence spending probably rates in the top three or four defense budgets in the world by itself. So it tells me that the U.S. defense industry and global industry, looking at the U.S. defense market, there's still a lot there and will continue to be. China, though, and Russia, for that matter, are right there in the top five. And they continue. Now, the difference, I would say, that you need to put in perspective is that China and Russia, primarily China, but Russia to a certain extent, even though they've been deployed to Syria recently and have some activity, obviously, in the Ukraine eastern area, but mostly are not deployed. China, particularly, they work out of their own backyard. Deployments cost a lot of money. They're tough on equipment, they're tough on people, and it costs a lot of operational and maintenance money on a daily basis. So a lot of our spending is put into deployments around the world, which, again, you can argue whether you like that or not. I would argue that we are a global power and we need to act like it. But it gives China and Russia somewhat of an advantage that they're not spending money on these deployments. So the difference in the spending is a little bit skewed, but still the U.S. is way up there. And needs to be, I would say, for the foreseeable future.
Plus the salaries and the benefits and the health care costs, housing costs of U.S. troops and the civilian infrastructure that supports them is probably a lot more per person than it would be in China or Russia also.
Well, absolutely. I would say two things. One is that's true. We have an all-volunteer force, and you have to pay people that are talented to stay. It's competitive. We're competing with the private commercial economy as well, number one. Number two is, I would argue, I don't think there's any argument, the United States has the most talented, the most capable military personnel in the world. I mean, I've been all over the world, deployed, seen all of the militaries, and there's nothing that compares to the U.S. military. So that takes training, equipment, it takes competitive talent recruitment and maintenance and maintaining talent. But it's costly. And if you look at the healthcare requirements, a lot of that has to do with the casualties we've incurred over the last 15 years or so in the Middle East. We're committed to our troops after, during, and after conflict, and we'll take care of them for the rest of their lives. That's costly. There's nothing like U.S. military medical care. I've never seen anything like it in my life from the standpoint of the technology in the field. That costs money, but we're not going to back away from that. So as you point out, our costs are a little different than, say, the rest of the world from the standpoint of what we're putting the money in. But we're still, from a equipment standpoint, we're still putting money in very, very, very good equipment. So I think our U.S. defense capability is second to none. There's nothing that comes close, and we're going to have to continue to do that. Now, again, economies and demands around the world continue to press for that military spending, but I see the United States staying at the level you just pointed out for the foreseeable future.
Retired Air Force General Chuck Wald is Vice Chairman and Senior Advisor at Deloitte. As always, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
You can read more and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive and click Share with Friends.